a lot of people feel a lot of guilt and shame because struggles with pornography and other sexual behaviors can generally very private. And for people who are Christian, they can feel a great weight, even teenagers and kids who can feel a great weight of guilt. And so that can be crippling. And if they've been isolated and not talked to anyone and had this burden for years, right, they can very, very quickly have a discouraged faith. So you want to say, listen, God loves you. Jesus died for you. He knows you're a sinner. He understands your struggles. He doesn't want you to run away. He wants you to come to him.
Welcome back to the Effective Ministry Podcast, the podcast that helps you have an effective youth and children's ministry in your local church. I'm Tim Bielhartz, a children's ministry advisor for YouthWorks in Sydney. And this week, I've got the first of a two-part conversation with Marshall Ballantyne-Jones and Emma Argyle about the challenges we face raising children and youth in a highly sexualized world, especially one in which pornography consumption is so high. My two guests are experts on this topic of young people and pornography. Marshall's recent PhD was with Sydney University and focused on reducing the negative effects of pornography and sexualized social media behaviors on adolescents. He is currently the CEO of DigiHelp Publishing, developing school-based solutions for online behavior challenges, after previously working as a publisher, an Anglican minister, youth worker, and programmer. So Marshall has done a lot of deep thinking and research on this topic. But not at all outshone in practical experience, Emma is a high school teacher teaching English, history, Christian studies, and studies of religion at a Sydney Christian school. And as you'll hear, has been prompting conversations with her students about pornography and sexualization for the best part of almost 20 years. This is a challenging episode for a number of reasons. It can be confronting and upsetting to hear about the saturation of pornography in the lives of young people, the huge numbers of young people in our youth ministries who are consuming and possibly addicted to porn, and the alarming age of first exposure that means that many in our children's ministry are also affected by this content. But this may also be a challenging episode for you because you yourself are struggling with pornography, consumption, and addiction. In next week's episode, you'll hear Marshall talk more about his Resist ministry and the ways you can begin to find help and healing if you are struggling with your own addictions. But I want to flag this up top so that you can seek out help if you are in that place. So check out resistporn.org, and there you will find lots of resources for yourself, perhaps for a loved one, or for those in your church and youth ministry. As I've said, this week is just part one of our conversation. We delve into some definitions and statistics around porn use. Marshall shares his thoughts on whether it is appropriate to define compulsive use as an addiction. We talk about the theological and the pastoral implications of porn consumption. And then next week, both Marshall and Emma will talk about the tools and resources that they've been developing in this space to help young people resist porn and have positive understandings of sex and relationships. And we also chat about the importance of parents and culture setting in our Christian communities. That's plenty from me up top. Let's jump into my conversation with Marshall Ballantyne-Jones and Emma Argyle.
Well, I'm here with Emma and Marshall. Thank you for joining the podcast, guys. It's great to be here with you. Let's start with a fairly obvious question. What is pornography? How would you describe it? Marshall, do you want to kick us off with a definition?
Sure. Well, pornography essentially is any media that sexually arouses. The origins of the words, the two Greek words, porneia, which means sexual immorality or prostitution, and graphē, which means writings. So writings about sex. But in our modern context, most people most of the time think of pictures, images, and videos of people engaging in sexual activity. But it doesn't have to be that. It can also be other forms of media that arouses, and one particular genre might be literature or hentai, which is Japanese anime, cartoon, sexual stuff. So whatever turns someone on can be loosely described as pornography.
And part of the reason we're having this conversation and part of the challenge that we face as ministry leaders is just the size of the problem, both for those of us who are in ministry, and also for particularly for those, the young ones that we're ministering to and trying to disciple. Marshall, with your research, you've done a lot of stats and research on this. Give us a bit of a sense of the size of pornography consumption in the typical Western world where we are right now.
Look, it's massive. At the biggest picture, biggest scope, we know that there's a huge volume of pornography searches happening every week. For example, a study of a major international marketing company who monitors what people consume on the internet was done in July this year, 2023. And they found that in just that month alone, there were 40 billion searches, unique searches on pornography sites, 40 billion. Now, they estimate that there's roughly 5 billion people worldwide on the internet. So that's rough as guts, one search a day for that month per person. Mm. But of course, that's not the actual situation of who's looking at pornography. We know from worldwide studies, domestic studies, that roughly 70 to 90% of adult males are actively looking at pornography, and anywhere between 20 to 50% of females. Does differ from country to country, but for young people, for teenagers in Sydney, Australia, roughly 7 out of 10 boys are looking at pornography at a regular basis. That's at least multiple times a month, moving towards multiple times a week, even daily. And about 2 out of 10 girls are looking at pornography. Not as frequently as guys, but only about 5% of females will be looking at pornography in the same level that the average guy who looks at porn will be. But essentially, those stats of the 7 out of 10 boys, 2 out of 10 girls, are true in Christian communities, whether they be evangelical or another denomination, in Sydney right now. Also, we know that the average age of exposure, first-time exposure pornography worldwide, is about 11, and that seems to be roughly true here in Sydney as well, and in Australia as well, 11 to 11 and a half for both boys and girls, which is about the time that they get access to their first mobile phone. Normally, year 5, year 6 is when they first get it, and that happens to coincide with when they first see porn, where they also get their first social media account. So there's some stats for you.
Emma, you have the experience of being in a school and interacting with the young people themselves. Would you see that data played out in the actual relationships that you are having?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think I started speaking to students about pornography as, you know, something that was a reality in their lives in about, you know, maybe 2004. And that, you know, smartphones weren't necessarily as ubiquitous. At the time, I was in a co-ed school in Sydney and chatting with, yeah, students about it and just really feeling like I needed to talk about it in terms of like, you're boys and girls together, you seem to relate really well, you have these beautiful friendships, but I'm concerned that, like, this is the way I was approaching it, I'm concerned that your growing porn consumption for some of you is going to just really affect the way that you see one another. And I started to raise concerns about what the impact of it would be on their friendships, their ability to see one another as human beings. And I remember very early in that process, at the end of a year 12 class, a particular boy who was like absolute, you know, Sydney private school captain material, you know, like wore his uniform impeccably, amazing at sports, delightful boy, you know, like a kid that every single person would be deeply impressed with. And he stayed behind after a lesson. And he said to me, Mrs. Ogle, you're the first adult who's ever talked to me about pornography. And when I was in year 7, my parents bought me a laptop and set it up in my room for me to use for high school. And so it's set up in my room. And pretty much from that first week, I realized that I could look up pornography on the computer. And I have now pretty much done that every day of my life since year 7. And you're the first one who's raised it. And you're right. I have these friends who are girls who are so precious to me, whose friendship I value so deeply. And I realize as you're talking, yeah, I have begun to see those girls in ways that would horrify them because of the stuff that I'm exposing myself to. And he was like, what do I do? How do I fix it? How do I stop? But at that particular stage, there wasn't a lot of stuff out there to really point him towards. But it was like devastating to have my hunch confirmed in such a kind of stark way. So I think that's a really common experience. I think kids And that's a boy who came and said it to me as a teacher, you know, in that context, that's pretty rare. I mean, I think it is pretty revealing of that as a reality. And then, you know, Marshall mentioned kids getting their first social media account. I think I've heard from a number of students, you know, getting Snapchat accounts from the age of 9 and not so much going out seeking pornography, but being approached by predatory adult men who are trying to approach kids in that platform and, you know, being sent graphic pictures of adult male genitalia daily and never telling their parents about it because they knew that if they told their parents about it, that would be the end of their Snapchat account. You know, there's just so many ways in which our kids are either going out seeking pornography intentionally in a habitual way because it's normalized and all of that kind of thing, and also all of the ways that it just floods into them. I know a boy in year 8 sitting innocently in his English class and had a kid turn his phone towards him with a gif of a sex act that I won't go into, but you know, he's just sitting there in English, minding his own business, and is exposed in that way. So that's super normal activity for kids on the bus, on the way home from school, just all over the place. They are exposed to pornography, whether or not they're going seeking it. And it's just so much a part of the way they interact that it's really tricky to escape.
Absolutely. That insidious nature of, you know, it could come from someone on the bus, someone in class. It could be your normal searches or normal reels on your social media account, and you just flick one across and suddenly it's just there. It's just always prevalent. One of the things to talk about in this space is what's going on neurologically for the person who's consuming porn. And particularly, you get very early into the question of whether porn itself is addictive. Marshall, this was part of the study that you did. How would you define the term addiction? What's going on in the brain of a person who is consuming porn? Would you count impulsive consumption of porn as an addiction? How do all those questions play out for you in your research?
It is a contested space for a number of reasons, which I won't go into too much detail, but in some areas of the world, particularly in America, where they have authorities about what defines addiction and compulsive behaviors, they're reluctant to describe compulsive pornography use as addictive. While over in Europe, the World Health Organization, with their international classification of diseases, does call certain sexual compulsive behaviors addiction, and they include pornography as a subset. So when we're talking the term addiction, you've got to be careful that if you're using it clinically with professionals in the psychological field, it's a contested space. When I talk about addiction loosely to people, I'm talking about people with a compulsive behavior, which when they try to stop, they simply can't do it. And, you know, again, there's a scale of how powerful that compulsion is on different people. And there are actual legitimate ways of measuring that with proper psychometric studies and so forth. But at the end of the day, when we're talking about someone who feels that they can't stop, tries to stop, but keeps repeating the behavior, and I imagine there'll be people listening to this podcast and they'll know that's talking about them. Maybe they were the kid at 11 or 10 or 12 or whenever, when they first got their glimpse of pornography, and it's been a present companion of their life since. And now they're an adult and they've, for reasons might relate to their Christianity or because it's just undesirable, they've been trying to stop and they can't. So what we do know is that there is a very real brain mechanic going on with people who have compulsive behaviors. And the mechanics that many, many neurological studies have now been done on porn users show that the parts of the brains which are engaged with compulsive behaviors in those people are similar to those who have other behavioral and even substance abuse challenges. And so, I mean, just loosely, there is a big contest in everyone's brains at any given time between their emotional center, which is what we call the limbic system, which is made up of lots of components. And there's also the control and thinking part of the brain, which we call the prefrontal cortex, which is behind the forehead. And those two parts are in constant contest. When I want to do something because I feel like it, I have to make a judgment call about whether it's wise to do that. I often say to the kids, well, you know, if there's a plate of donuts on the kitchen bench and it's 10 minutes before dinner and I'm hungry, do I go for the donuts or do I wait for dinner? And this could be an easy decision for some people. They'll just resist. Others can't resist. even though they're going to get in big trouble from their mum or whatever. So it's like this is a wrestle between that feeling center and the decision center of the brains. But what we know is that the more you look at porn and the more you masturbate to pornography, the more that you invoke your sexual systems, you actually start to rapidly change the way your brain functions. The sexual process itself involves a huge volume of complex hormones. It's a very, very powerful, probably the most powerful natural brain sensation that we have. And there's dopamine, which is the reward hormone. Many people know about dopamine. It gets invoked whenever we're anticipating excitement or going through a buzz. But there's also changes to our serotonin and our noradrenaline levels. We get large doses of natural opioids called endorphins and enkephalins. And we invoke our bonding and cuddle hormones, which is oxytocin and vasopressin. So those different hormones that get invoked can turn the brain into a fast track, super stimulated, obsessive unit that just wants to revisit the pleasure that we've trained it to receive. And so what we find with people who've been looking at porn regularly over time is that their brain defaults to using porn under all sorts of circumstances, whether they're stressed or they're bored or they're busy or they're excited, whether they get a trigger looking at someone who's attractive to them, the brain just wants to default to it. And the more that you encourage it by dwelling on pornography and masturbating to it, the more your brain's going to actually create new neural pathways that fast track that. So yes, it's real. That is compulsion. The brain changes. And that's why so many young people, so many Christians who try to stop after their desire and convictions have compelled them to struggle. And this creates a great sense of disappointment when they find it difficult to do it easy. So often I get asked, well, what do I do then if this is what's happened to me in my brain? How do I let my body catch up with my desire now, which is to be godly and restrained from this? But the answer is you need a process and you need a long process. Normally, when we develop a compulsive behavior, whether it be computer gaming or social media or eating or porn or gambling or some other compulsion, we've invested many, 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 many hours into the development of that. For us to click our fingers, expect a silver bullet and suddenly be cured is just unscientific. Mm. And so what we need to accept is that we're going to need to put in a proportionate response. That is, we're going to have to put in many, many hours of effort and intentional action to let our brains change, heal, and develop new interests and new preoccupations so that when we have those stresses and those boredoms and those triggers, it's not porn we go to, it's something else.
That's really, really helpful to understand. We'll get more to what to do next as we go. But it's not just a neurological challenge. Obviously, as we're talking as Christians, so there's a theological aspect here that we're actually addressing porn. We believe that there's a sinful aspect here. There's something that is undesirable from a disciple of Jesus point of view. Emma, do you want to just talk about what are some of the theological things we need to be thinking about? Why is porn a sin? What is it that makes this an undesirable act as someone who's striving to, you know Jesus more, love him more, and follow him more each day?
Yeah, I think in my context, often I'm talking to kids who aren't necessarily coming from a Christian background. So I'm probably a bit careful about the way I invoke the sin word. But I think, you know, for those of us who are in ministry and thinking this through, you know, we're pretty comfortable with the realities that, you know, God has created us to have certain kinds of relationships. God's created us to honor him, to love him, you know, made in his image, to kind of reflect that to one another. And so there's so many ways in which pornography, you know, flies in the face of so many of those things. So if we're, there's an element of human beings being degraded and kind of reduced to body parts and, you know, their value, which is only to do with, you know, their ability to perform certain acts, you know, that's devoid of any of their other, you know, God-given characteristics. the things that make us human and make us relational, make us creative. So I think that that kind of deep devaluing of the human person that comes out of pornography is a really significant aspect of you know, something that's deeply displeasing to God when we take his creatures and limit them so much from the scope of beauty and amazingness that God has given us. And I think that exploitative nature of people, you know, from, you know, anyone who's had a brief glimpse into the porn industry would know it's an incredibly exploitative industry in which women, children, men are used and spat out in ways that are just devastating. So Gail Dines is an author who wrote a book called Pornland, and Melinda Takeout-Reese has done work in that space as well, and lots of people looking into what actually happens in the lives of porn performers and you know, how devastating that is. So that exploitative element, there's also obviously a trafficking element. So much of pornography that also plays into that devaluing of the human person. Mm. But I think within ourselves as well, what happens when, you know, we go seeking after those sensations that Marshall's talked about, that we prioritize our sexual pleasure over and above a whole lot of elements of what it is for us to be human, what it is for us to be relational. There's a kind of deep selfishness to that and an idolatry there, where we begin to, you know, worship the created thing rather than the creator. And we elevate the importance of those aspects of our lives and relationships that just, yeah, take away from the richness and the beauty of what it is to be, you know, fully human, and what it is to be in good relationships with one another. I mean, one of the things I talk about with kids a lot is the way that, you know, you might see a movie, like a, you know, just a movie at the cinema, and the characters that you'd meet in the movie are, you know, fully developed in lots of ways that we get brief glimpses into. You know, they'll have a job, they'll have neighbors, they'll have a hobby maybe, they'll have a dog, they'll have some kind of goal in their lives. You know, we get a bit of a sense of a whole person, and maybe there'll be a romance plot, maybe there'll even be a sex scene, but, you know, there's more to that person than just that. Whereas pornography is devoid of all of those other aspects of the human person, just reduces us to so little. And then just with regard to what God has made sex to be as well, you know, given that it's got a purpose within marriage to unite a husband and wife, and when we take it out of that context, we begin to kind of worship it for a thing in and of itself. And in doing that, we also continue on with that kind of elevation of sex over and above all other things. So I think what happens with kids in terms of how they think about their relationships, they often think, okay, in order for me to be able to be attractive in a relationship, I've got to develop this set of skills that I can then perform once I'm in a relationship. And porn really feeds that notion that sex is, yeah, a thing in and of itself that takes on its own life outside of good relational harmony. That makes sense.
Absolutely. Yeah. You gave a talk recently where you mentioned one of your points was sex is incredible in the right context, but you are incredible in so many more contexts than just sex. And I think that really sums up what you were just saying there. God has given us a good vision of sex, and he's also given us a good vision of who we are, of which sex is but a small part. Now, this starts to turn us towards, I suppose, telling the opposite story, telling the positive story of our bodies and who we are. So we've got this mixture then of, there's a neurological point of view, there's lots of things happening in our brain chemistry. There is a theological component, particularly for those of us who are in churches, who are interacting with kids or in ministries, or it might be school context, where the child or young person in front of us wants to be a disciple of Jesus and is wrestling with this. How do I bring these two perspectives together? How do I start to help this young person in front of me, if I'm a youth leader, even a children's leader, if it's, you know, if it's 11 is the earliest exposure, then we've got some in our children's ministry who are exposed to this. How do I start with that young person in front of me? Marshall, what are some advice for the youth leaders and children's ministers who are listening?
Well, firstly, I think the assumption is that there are people in front of you who this is relevant to. And those averages are applicable to Christian communities that I said before. So this right now is true, but I don't think that means you need to, as the individual leader, go out and hunt for people's private stories. But I think certainly as ministries, it needs to be actively and strategically discussed amongst the leadership that how do we address sexualization of our young people? that's a discussion that should be done in consultation with the wider church leadership as well, because the sexuality is always a very sensitive issue. And whenever you're dealing with children and teenagers and sexuality, it's more than sensitive. It's you're at the heart of child protection. And so you need to make sure that you guys have approached this with as much care and as much strategy as possible. I think first and foremost, when you want to address anything to do with sexuality, whether it be you want to talk about pornography, whether you want to talk about engagement with sexual themes in society or sexual content on mainstream media like Netflix or social media, that you shouldn't say anything that is not disclosed to their parents, right? And there's a few reasons for this. Parents are singly the most effective influence on the lives of children for how they engage and think and behave sexually. And every study shows this. And so if we think, oh, well, I know my kids in my youth group, I've got 7 out of 10 boys who are struggling with this. Well, I'll start helping them out there. And you don't think about their parents. You're not going to even make a difference, because presuming that the ones struggling with this have compulsions and no once a week message or once a term message or once a year message, which some youth groups do, is going to make a difference. What's going to matter is how their home environment is structured, what their parents say and act and believe and teach about this. And so it's important that you work with the parents of your kids. Secondly, don't say anything to kids which you're not an expert on. You can actually be more harmful than helpful if you address, like, for example, you want to talk about porn, sexuality, don't masturbate or something like that. But say that's your message. But if you've got a couple of kids who are listening to that and they've been sexually abused in the past or at home or something that's traumatizing for them, or they maybe have never had any understanding or exposure to sexuality, there is a minority of boys and still by mid-high school, just a majority of girls who are pretty naive to sexual issues. And you can suddenly be thrusting on them content which they're not ready for or mature for, you see. So you've got to be very sensitive. But say you've got someone who comes to you and says, hey, I've got this private struggle, all right? Well, then of course, you don't deal with them just privately. You want to make sure that it's transparent, as you would with all child protection type issues. But at this point, you'd want to encourage them to disclose, if it was a boy, to his dad, say, dad, I've got the struggle, so that even if that takes a bit of work to convince them. And you, of course, want to bring them into an environment where they are exposed immediately to the love and the grace of the Lord Jesus, because a lot of people feel a lot of guilt and shame because struggles with pornography and other sexual behaviors are generally very private. And for people who are Christian, they can feel a great weight, even teenagers and kids who can feel a great weight of guilt. And so that can be crippling. And if they've been isolated and not talked to anyone, and had this burden for years, right, they can very, very quickly have a discouraged faith. So you want to say, listen, God loves you. Jesus died for you. He knows you're a sinner. He understands your struggles. He doesn't want you to run away. He wants you to come to him. You want to give that message, you know, the woman caught in adultery, John 8 sort of stuff, right? And remind them that this is not the thing that's going to separate them from God. But you also want to affirm to them that God has a grander vision for them. He has a grander vision for the way they live, the way they think, the way they behave. And he knows, as it was true in the Bible in the New Testament time, that people struggle with all sorts of things, including sexuality. And so the encouragement is we want to move you towards healthy living. And so if there's ways that we can support you through accountability, encouragement, and maybe engaging with some of your peers, you take those steps. Once you're over 16 years old, moving into adulthood, we can have a lot more substantial contribution. But at any rate, I think at any age, you assume kids have exposure to sexual material I was going to say one other thing. One thing that any leader can do is they can model good behavior and they can model the right way to treat one another. One of the things that you'll see so frequently in a gathering of teenagers, often teenage boys, is that you'll hear lewd jokes and just short sexual content. And some leaders sometimes laugh along and participate. We want to have a high bar for that with our kids. We don't want to in any way cheapen or diminish God's wonderful, incredible, powerful gift of sexuality. We want to uphold it. We want to keep pointing to the grand vision that God has for human relationships, particularly human sexual relationships. And that is not only sex is just for marriage, but God knows how humans work best. And he designed sex so well that it's going to amplify and improve marriage if we treat it well. And so we want to say, this is the destination God has for you. He wants, if you're going to get married, and that's not a case going to be for every kid, but if marriage is your future, you want to hit that marriage with as much health as you can and not baggage. And so paint the vision that what you decide now as a kid, how you use your time and your mind, will be an investment in the future and for those important relationships and interactions that you'll have.
Well, as I said, this is just the first of my two-part conversation with Marshall and Emma. Make sure you like and subscribe to this podcast feed in your favorite podcast app so that you're ready for part two to drop next Wednesday. And remember to check out Marshall's site, resistporn.org, if you or someone you know needs help resisting the addictive but ultimately destructive consumption of porn.
The Effective Ministry Podcast is a production of Youth Works in Sydney. We want to see effective youth and children's ministry in every church. And one of the ways that you can help us do that is by letting people know about this podcast in all the usual ways, like, comment, share, and review on your favorite social media and podcasting platform. If you've got comments, thoughts, or questions for this podcast, you can email us at effectiveministrypodcast@youthworks.net. And also check out youthworks.net for other ways that YouthWorks can help you have an effective youth and children's ministry in your church.